If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Get it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast about movies. All kinds of movies. Crime movies, science fiction movies, horror movies, movies with cool actors you've never heard of in them, movies where CGI stands for criminals, girls and ice picks, classic movies, cult movies, and any other movie Terry wants to rant about as long as the movie is more than 20 years old. You can find the podcast website at paleo-cinema.com. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can email or send MP3 voicemails to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast usually contains swearing and is probably not safe for work unless you work in a brothel or a David Mamet film.
Hi and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 106. My name is Terry Frost and this time around we're looking at a couple of films from the 1950s. First one being Private Hell 36, a movie directed by Don Siegel, written by and starring Ida Lupino. It's got Howard Duff in it as well, Steve Cochran, and Dean Jagger. So it's not a bad little minor crime film from that time. The other film I'm talking about is a much bigger and much more interesting film, which is 1957's Witness for the Prosecution, directed by Billy Wilder and starring Tyrone Power, Charles Laughton, Elsa Lanchester and Marlene Dietrich. Hope everyone's doing fine out there. If this sounds a little bit different, it is different because I've got myself a new microphone. It's on an arm and it's got a pop filter in it. And I thought I'd go kind of semi-professional, so I sprung $125 and got myself a nice mic that I could hang through the mixer. And kind of not just sit there with the headsets on and do it that way. So now I've got a proper mic setup. Interesting thing about that, the mic setup is beautiful. The mic is actually gold. It's a pretty looking mic. It's in a little shock cradle as well. It's on an arm. It's very, very groovy. The only downside to this is the new man cave, my brand new man cave, has really shit acoustics, so there is going to be a little bit of a background buzz. I'm not sure what I'm going to do about that. I may underlay some music underneath this, but it swings and roundabouts. Unless I want to kind of put a whole bunch of soundproofing around the shelves and on the ceiling and things like that, it's the sound quality is going to suffer for having a better microphone, which is really interesting. And it's a learning curve for me too, as a podcaster and as a broadcaster, that sometimes the equipment is let down by the environment. So I hope it doesn't sound too bad, and I'm really going to try to ensure that it doesn't. But you live and learn. I mean, I sprung out the money for it, and then the infrastructure around me has let me down. Things here are going pretty well. It's starting to turn into spring now, even though outside every 10 minutes or so we're getting a rainstorm and it's quite chilly out there. Melbourne's in a peculiar position. There's a thing called thermal inertia, which means that the weather gets very dynamic as the seasons change. We get a lot of wind, a lot of rain and things like that, and we have been getting a large chunk of that lately. The other good news is that the radio gig's back on. We had a bit of a hiatus while the Five Ring Circus was on in London. But now Ivor and I are back on track and we're doing what we love doing on record on a Friday night, but it's broadcast the subsequent Thursday. And we've done two movies that I really liked so far and had a lot of fun with them. The first one was, we did The African Queen a while back, and that's a lot of fun with Bogart and Hepburn. Talked about that. The last movie we did was Across 110th Street, a very early kind of blaxploitation film, but which really transcends the genre. It's got Anthony Quinn, Anthony Franciosa, Yaphet Kotto, and a bunch of other people in it, and really a fine piece of 1970s action cinema with a fantastic soundtrack by Bobby Womack. So we've recorded that one, and that's going to be broadcast as I record next Thursday night. I'll put something up on Facebook for people to take a look at there and see if they can tune in through the streaming media to enjoy that. A lot of fun, and I hadn't seen Across 110th Street since about the time it came out, really. It was in the 70s, and I'd forgotten totally about it, and I really loved revisiting it. I really do recommend that film. At some stage, I may podcast about it as well. It really is worth time and attention to talk about what makes that film so special. The interesting thing there, too, is one of the listeners to the ABC radio gig in the Northern Territory has suggested, and in fact has dared us, to watch a movie and to review it. So the next movie we're doing, recording next week as I speak, is Last Tango in Paris. And I believe that somewhere along the line, as we do so, I may mention dairy products of some kind. But I'll let you know how that one goes, and it should be a lot of fun to do. It's going to be challenging to do it within the limitations of radio. The limitations of radio here in Australia are somewhat less than they are in other places. I think we're going to have to tread slightly carefully in looking at it. So I took up the dare immediately, said, let's do it next week. We'll see how we go. Flying by the seat of our pants. But yeah, it's been going okay here. Let me see. I'm going to check out what I have been watching apart from those two things I've mentioned. DC, doo-doo-doo-doo. I did get the Blu-ray of The Avengers because I'm a kind of comic book geek from way back. A lot of fun. I did see a movie that I just got a poster for. I picked up a Daybill poster for the film, so I thought I'd better check it out. It's called Grand Slam. It's a crime movie with Edward G. Robinson, Janet Leigh, and a bunch of other people in it. Klaus Kinski's in it as well, Adolfo Celli, Robert Hoffman. Not a bad little Eurocrime, Eurospy kind of film from 67. Robinson's in it, but not all the way through. He kind of comes in at the top and tail of the film. But it's worth checking out. Nice little crime movie, little heist caper. It's worth looking into, but nothing beyond the okie-dokie. Let me see. What else I see? It's only been 2 weeks since I recorded the last Martian Drive-In podcast, by the way, which I did with my mate Mondi. And, yeah, it really was a lot of fun to do that. So haven't really been keeping up on my Mizo. So there's nothing else apart from those films I've already mentioned that really stands out for me. Been watching a bit of TV and just generally kicking back, grooving on the vibe of taking it easy. That's about it for that part. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take a break. And when I get back, we're going to have a chat about Private Hell 36, one of the few movies named after what we in Australia call a caravan and what people in America call a camper trailer or something like that. Back soon.
Do you enjoy movies like Carnival of Souls, The Mole People, Black Sunday, and The Tingler? Do you find yourself late at night reading magazines such as Film Max, Chiller Theater, or Monster Bash? Do you love vintage television programs like Sky King, Outer Limits, and The Time Tunnel? Do you find yourself surfing the net looking for the next Monster Movie Festival or Expo? Do you enjoy hearing anecdotes, cinematic details, and unusual insights into some of your favorite movies? If you answered yes to any of the above, you're encouraged to join your host, Vince Rotolo, as he examines some of the latest horror, sci-fi, and cult theatrical releases, new DVDs to add to your collection, and of course, the old classics, both good and bad. He even interviews people throughout B-Moviedom. So tune into B-MovieCast at bmoviecast.com.
Resistance is futile.
Talk to the trees, but they don't listen to me. I talk to the stars, but they never hear me. The breeze hasn't time to stop and hear what I say. I talk to them all. But suddenly my words reach someone else's ear, touch someone else's heartstrings too. I tell you my dreams, and while you're listening to me, I suddenly see them come true. I can see us on an April night, looking out across a rolling farm, having supper in the candlelight, walking later arm in arm. Then I'll tell you how I pass the day, thinking mainly how the night would be. Then I'll try to find the words to say all the things you mean to me. I tell you my dreams, and while you're listening to me, I suddenly see them come true.
Sorry, but I had to throw that one in there. Yeah, it was Clint Eastwood from Paint Your Wagon singing I Talk to the Trees. So he's not unfamiliar with discourse with inanimate objects. Ah, dear. Anyway, on to Private Hell 36. It was directed by Don Siegel in 1954 and was written by Collier Young and Ida Lupino, who were, up until 1951, married together. They also had a production company called The Filmmakers, who they were part of. Now, in 1951, Ida Lupino and Collier Young divorced, and Ida Lupino married the actor Howard Duff, who stars in Private Hell 36 with her. I'll just do the praise here of the movie from the Wikipedia. Two LA detectives, Cal Brunner, played by Steve Cochran, and Jack Farnham, played by Howard Duff, get in over their heads when they decide to split up thousands of dollars they found on a recently killed counterfeiter. To make matters worse, they are assigned by their police captain to look for the missing cash. Things get even worse when one cop gets romantically involved with a money-hungry nightclub singer. When Farnham decides to turn honest and hand the money over to his superiors, the other cop decides to take it all. I'll play a clip from the movie now, and then you can get a bit of a feel for it, and then talk about the actors and why I kind of like this film. Even though it's not large, it's not really anything we've not seen before, and it doesn't throw too many new surprises at us.
Hides their faces. Five people living on the edge of evil, making their own private hell. Ida Lupino, Steve Cochran, Howard Duff, Dean Jagger, and Dorothy Malone, in a story of one woman's whole love, another woman's unholy fascination, and the shocking jolt of her impact on two men.
Can't even look at my own kid anymore.
Does a man figure in this?
Man figures? If he likes the things I like, you can afford them.
Look, Lily, is it just dough that's worrying you? Maybe I can afford you.
Shut up. What I do is none of your business.
What happens to a man who loves a woman like this?
They're off and running.
To what lengths would he go to get her what she wants? Will he gamble? Yes. Will he steal? Will he kill?
Drop that gun.
It hits with all the drive of desperate desire.
What do you mean?
Thought I'd try Las Vegas for a while. It's quite a spot. You ever been there?
Nope.
Well, I thought with all that loot floating around, there ought to be a way of getting some of it for little me. Don't you think?
Yeah, sure. Who's going to stake you? Oh, that's a silly question, isn't it?
I don't like that.
So you don't like it? Lily, if it's money that's troubling you, maybe I can afford you. How does that sound?
Like a pretty cold proposition. Thanks, I'll make it under my own steam.
Yeah, I bet you will. You should be a smash with that voice of yours. That's what you had in mind, isn't it? Singing.
Shut up. What I do is none of your business.
It has been.
You dirty little cop. What's to keep me here?
Me?
That's a laugh. I was getting along fine until I met you. Sure, I was broke. I still am. But I didn't have to answer to anybody, and that's the way I like it.
Oh, that's the way you like it, is it? That's why you're running out, huh? You're stuck for me. That's why you're running out. Same as I am for you. Isn't that right?
Leave me alone, will you?
Answer me.
Leave me alone.
Isn't that right?
I don't know.
That last bit was Steve Cochran and Ida Lupino in one of the scenes from Private Hill 36. The title of the movie is a little bit unusual. Private Hill 36 is a reference to a camper trailer that the two cops, played by Howard Duff and Steve Cochran, hire so that they can stash their loot in it. So the whole point is that they find the loot on the counterfeiter who's just died in a car accident that they caused with a cop chase. They then, Steve Cochran's character steals the money and gets his reluctant mate, Howard Duff, to come along with it. Now, the Howard Duff character, Farnham, is a family man. He's got a wife, played by Dorothy Malone, in a very kind of underwritten and minor role, a recent child, and basically they're struggling a little bit. They've got a house payments to make for their mortgage. They're kind of doing it a little bit tough. But the idea of stealing $80,000 and keeping it and just holding on to it and laying low until the hot money cools off is really something that starts eating away at Farnham's conscience. He sees himself as a good cop, and because his partner's suddenly stolen this money, which they can't give back because they've already told their boss, played by Dean Jagger, that that's all the money there was. They leave most of the money in the strongbox that's found on this guy's wrecked car. And the Howard Duff character really does go through a lot of moral qualms about doing this, and ultimately that leads to other things because it's found out that the guy who died in a car accident had a partner who knows exactly how much money was in that particular box and starts attempting to blackmail the cops. So that's one stream of the movie. The movie actually starts out pretty well with a nice Don Siegel action sequence. Steve Cochran's cop finds a robbery taking place in a closed pharmacy. And he kind of goes in with his gun. There's no lights on. He knows somebody's in there. And a little bit of gunplay and a lot of biff ensues, including quite a harsh fist-fighting scene, which is, I kind of like. I like that grittiness that Siegel always brought to action sequences. Of course, that's what he's known for most. But this was a fairly early Don Siegel movie, and it does hold up pretty well. But because it was partly written by Ida Lupino, it's got a slightly different cant. It doesn't have guys needing to be tough for the sake of being tough. The guys in it are tough because, you know, they're cops in one case. The Steve Cochran character, who's very morally compromised, is on a stakeout to try to find who these counterfeiters are at a racetrack. And he gets corrupted by how much wealth and money flowing through that place he sees. And, of course, he's hooked up with a nightclub singer. They find in a nightclub where one of the counterfeit bills was passed, played by Ida Lupino, a lady called Lily, who is very, very similar to a character Ida Lupino played in a previous movie, one I've talked about in Paleo Cinema, which is Roadhouse from 1948, where she played a nightclub singer and pianist called Lily. So it's almost like a continuity of the same character in this one. And she likes the good things in life. She's a bit down on her luck. She's not a very good singer, working in a bar on a main highway in Los Angeles. And she's really out for herself, and she wants to live life on her own terms, which is a very modern kind of approach, and it's one that the Lily Stevens character from Roadhouse had as well, living that kind of life on her own terms, making her own way, paying her own bills, and choosing which men she wants rather than the men choosing her. So she's very much a modern woman in that way, and I like that. I like Ida Lupino's forthrightness and her honesty, even though she is someone who likes to find things in life in this movie. She really does have her own idea of who she is, a clear idea of who she is and what she wants, and she understands men much, much better than men understand her. So it's, as I said, it's a minor film. It wasn't made for very much money at all, but there's an interesting scene in the bar where Lily works, where there's a bit of dialogue and a bit of to and fro and a bit of plot progression in there. Now, I thought it was on a set. It looks like a movie set, but then suddenly Steve Cochran opens the door and walks out onto a highway, a kind of main highway in Los Angeles, and you realise that was a location shot, but it was lit and looked exactly like a movie set. And it's a really interesting little juxtaposition of him opening that door, and it's not a back projection screen behind him at all. It's definitely a location shoot. And, it shows Don Siegel's work there. It's just a lovely piece of surprise. I mean, we expected to see one thing. You open the door and you get that kind of generic outdoor set kind of look. But no, they actually went and filmed it. And there are a lot of good locations in this film as well. A lot of locations around Los Angeles, as it was in the 1950s, at the Hollywood Park racetrack in particular. There are a lot of location shoots during the a race as well, which they have various characters, Ida Lupino's character, Howard Duff, and Steve Cochran walking around a racetrack while there are lots of people there at the races, and that kind of gives a kind of gritty reality to the story. And of course, this being a 1950s noir kind of film, it doesn't necessarily end well for some of the main characters. It does end very abruptly, the movie, with a bit of a twist. It's not particularly, from our point of view, a surprising twist, but I think it may have surprised audiences in the 1950s, because one of the things about films like this are they may come up with something that was new in 1954, a new kind of plot wrinkle, but as soon as that comes out, people are going to start seeing it on cop shows on television for the next 40 years, that variation of a plot. But it originated in a film like this. Problem is, we've seen all those cop shows since then, and it brings us a little bit ahead of the curve on the plot line. You think, so that's what's happening, where the characters and the audiences at the time may not have done so. So it's an interesting way that movies kind of make us realize how much we know about movies, even subconsciously, to have that kind of, we know what's going on well before the characters do, even though the audiences in the past didn't. But having said that, it's not a major Don Siegel thing, but if you like Don Siegel's work, it's worth checking out. I like it for Lupino more than anything else. I think that she was an interesting writer. She wrote about moral quandaries and things like that very well. And it's a nice little piece of pulpish noir from that time. It's worth checking out. I believe it's out on DVD at the moment. I'm not sure where I got my copy of it from. It's just something I found on a disc I had lying around, and I remembered the film from quite a while ago, and I thought I'd give it a go, and it did surprise me. It's watchable. It's not the best noir film I've ever seen, but it's not a small film. It worked within a budget. It worked with an ensemble of actors who knew each other and liked each other. There are a whole bunch of smaller bits and pieces in there as well. Actors like Richard Deacon, who was in The Dick Van Dyke Show, shows up in a small piece of the film. Now, one of the other things I wanted to mention was Steve Cochran. Really interesting actor. He died really early in incredibly unusual circumstances. Steve Cochran was a womanizer. I've got a list here of women that he slipped a length to at various times. You ready for this? Mae West, Jane Mansfield, Barbara Payton, Joan Crawford, Sabrina, Merle Oberon, Kay Kendall, Virginia Lord, Ida Lupino as well, and Mamie Van Doren. So here's how he died. He's at the age of 48. It's in June 15th, 1965. He died on his yacht off the coast of Guatemala. He had an acute lung infection. His body, along with three live but upset female assistants on the boat, remained aboard for 10 days because the women didn't know how to operate the boat. So there are these three women on a boat with the dead corpse of Steve Cochran in the tropics for 10 days. Eventually, the boat drifted ashore in Port Champerico in Guatemala and was found by the authorities. And a lot of people thought that Steve Cochran had been poisoned by one of the women, but it turns out that's not the case. So if you're going to die on a boat off the coast of Guatemala with lung infection and three chicks on board, you're not doing anything new. It was already done by Steve Cochran. It was a bit of a kind of okay B actor, nothing fantastically good, but he was kind of an honest, kind of brutish looking thuggy kind of, it's almost leading man but a little bit thuggish actor. But his death in some ways is much more interesting than any of the movies he appeared in. So that's about it for Private Hill 36. I'm going to take another break now and have a drink. And when I get back, I'm going to talk about the much more interesting of the two films I've got this time around, being 1957's Witness for the Prosecution, directed by Billy Wilder, starring Charles Laughton, Elsa Lanchester, Marlene Dietrich, and Tyrone Power in his very last feature film. Witness for the Prosecution. I love this film. I love it for a couple of reasons. The acting, I always get off on good actors, and we have Charles Laughton and Elsa Lanchester playing off against each other, which is terrific. You've got Marlene Dietrich in probably one of her best roles in her later career, Tyrone Power in his last one, and just a good ensemble. There are people in the movie like Torrin Thatcher playing the prosecuting attorney. You've got Una O'Connor playing the Scottish maid to the woman who gets killed. And just a whole bunch of other people who, their faces are very familiar to us, but they really do add to the ensemble of this film. It wasn't filmed in England. It's set in England, but it's not filmed in England. It was filmed in Hollywood, but it looks like England. The quality of the set design, which is exceptional. The set design is just beautifully done, particularly the courtroom, and a really nice scene set in post-war Germany. But it's a fantastic, beautifully rich set design. Unfortunately, the movie's in black and white, so you don't get the added value of colour. But anyway, I'm waffling a bit, so I'm going to go into the plot and work it from there. Here we go. So Wilfred Robarts, Charles Laughton, a master barrister, is in ill health. He takes Leonard Vole, played by Tyrone Power, as a client, over the protestations of his private nurse, Miss Plimsoll, played by Elsa Lanchester. The doctor doctors have told him to stay away from criminal cases. Vole is accused of murdering Miss Emily French, a rich older woman who has become enamoured of him, going so far as to make him the main beneficiary of her will. strong circumstantial evidence all points to Vole as the killer. When Sir Wilfred speaks with Vole's German wife Christine, played by Marlene Dietrich, he finds her rather cold and self-possessed, but she does provide an alibi. Therefore, he is greatly surprised when she is called as a witness for the prosecution. While the wife cannot testify against her husband, it is shown that Christine is in fact still married to another man, was in fact still married to another man when she wed Leonard, although Vole believes in good faith he was her first husband. She testifies that Leonard, on the night that Mrs. French died, told him that he had killed her and that her conscience forced her to finally tell the truth to in court. But that's only the first bit of it. So I'm not going to go any further than that because there are a couple of nice plot twists. And if you haven't seen the film, you're in for a nice ride with this one. It's beautifully done. Billy Wilder made it. Marlene Dietrich brought the property to his attention. And she said, I'm going to do this film, but I'll only do it if you're directing. And so it was actually based on a story by Agatha Christie, a novel by Agatha Christie, and a subsequent stage play, which was staged in London in the early 1950s. The movie varies from the play and the story a fair bit. The nurse isn't there. The barrister, Sir Wilfred, is not in ill health. In the movie, he's had a heart attack recently, and they pump him full of pills and injections and all sorts of other things to keep him going during what becomes a very arduous and complicated trial. But the old war horse is in the harness again and really wants to get things right, and he hates losing court cases. So his main motivation is one of pride, but he's a wily old fox. He's cunning, he's very acute and intelligent, but there is one other person in the story who's a couple of steps ahead of Sir Wilfred, and without giving away too much, that person really does pull off a couple of reverses before a reverse is pulled on that person and the plot unravels to something of a surprise ending. The movie is just lovely. The characters are well drawn. I'll just play a clip of Sir Wilfred chatting with his nurse, Miss Plimsoll, and you get a little bit of an idea of that beautiful, rich and affectionate banter that Charles Laughton and Elsa Lanchester brought to this movie in and her role indeed wasn't actually in the play. So I'll play that one.
What a beautiful day. I've been hoping we'd have a bit of sun for our homecoming. I always say it's worth having all the fog just to appreciate the sunshine. Is there too much of draft? Shall I roll up the window?
Just roll up your mouth. You talk too much. If I'd have known how much you talked, I'd never have come out of my coma. This thing weighs a ton.
Now, we've been flat on our back for 2 months. We'd better be careful. Lovely, lovely. Must be perfectly lovely to live and work in the Inns of Court. How lucky you lawyers are. I almost married a lawyer once. I was in attendance when he had his appendectomy and we became engaged as soon as he could sit up. And then peritonitis set in and he went like that.
He certainly was a lucky lawyer.
Teeny-weeny steps now, Sir Wilfred. We must remember we had a teeny-weeny heart attack.
Oh, shut up. Williams, my cane. Good afternoon. Thank you very much, everybody. Back to work.
Sir Wilfred, if you don't mind, I would like to read you a little poem we've composed to welcome you back.
Very touching, Miss McHugh. You can recite it after office hours in your own time. Now back to work. What's the matter with you?
Nothing. I'm just happy that you're old self again.
Any more sentimentality around here, I shall instantly go back to the hospital.
Not very likely. They won't take him back. He wasn't really discharged, you know. He was expelled for conduct unbecoming a cardiac patient.
Put these in water, blabbermouth.
So you can kind of see what I mean with that. He's just dismissive and cantankerous, and he does things like hide cigars in his walking stick so that she can't tell he's got cigars, and hides a cognac in a thermos of supposedly cocoa that he takes into the courtroom with him. He's just one of those, he's the worst patient possible, but there's a real affection between the two, which comes through the characters really well. A lot has been said about how Tyrone Power wasn't as good as the other actors in this film, but a couple of things. First off, I've spoken about Tyrone Power in Nightmare Alley, where he plays a not entirely dissimilar character, a kind of amoral, ruthless, good-looking man who plays on his charms and influences women with those charms. And this is very much a similar role. Power has been said not quite as good as the other actors. Not entirely true. The reason for that is the character of Leonard Vohl is bullshitting all the time. He lies to his wife, he lies to the court, he lies to Mrs. French, the woman that he picks up on in a hat shop. He lies to everybody in his life, basically. And he is that kind of opportunistic womanizer. He's broke, he's down on his luck, he really doesn't fit into the post-war world. And Power plays that really well. You can tell the brash self-confidence of Vohl is a facade, and that's only because Tyrone Power plays it that way. It's not a bad piece of acting, but it's an actor playing somebody who's not necessarily a good actor himself. And I find that really kind of interesting. I find it's a difficult one to play, that kind of two levels of things where the brash self-confidence but also the bullshitter. You've got to bring nuance to that, and I think the Power does that very well. It was his last feature role. He was making Solomon and Sheba a couple of years after this one, and unfortunately died of a heart attack on set, and the role was taken over by Yul Brynner. Power, he is looking a little bit kind of, his looks are starting to fade. He was in his 40s at the time, and he had some kind of undiagnosed heart condition. So he was looking a little bit puffy around the face. But that kind of works for the role. He's right physically and psychologically for the role. But, I do like him in this. There's a scene where they do a flashback to where he meets Christine, the wife played by Marlene Dietrich, in a really dodgy old nightclub in Berlin just as the war's ending. And Marlene Dietrich gets a chance to sing. She gets a chance to show her legs. And it's very, very similar to a few scenes in an earlier Billy Wilder movie starring Marlene Dietrich. And it's a movie from, I think it's about 1948, called A Foreign Affair. A Foreign Affair is set in post-war Germany as well, in the Reconstruction era. And Marlene Dietrich plays a character working in a nightclub in that and sings a couple of songs and a few other bits and pieces. So it kind of harks back to that a little bit. And it's nice to see the kind of flashback, because apart from building the relationship of the Vohl and his wife Christine, it gives us a break from the courtroom part of the movie. It's a nice little breathing space there that Billy Wilder puts in, and of course it's a lot of fun seeing Marlene Dietrich singing and just seeing the kind of affection that started to build between Vohl and Christine, and it adds a bit of power to the last twist in the film. And one of the things Billy Wilder has said about this film too is Agatha Christie's play and story gave him a great structure for the film. The plot twists and the revelations and the reverses and things like that are really, really great. But what it didn't have was realistic characters. So one of the things that Wilder and his screenwriter companions did for this film, now who were they? Let me have a look here. Larry Marcus, Billy Wilder and Harry Kernitz were the screenwriters. What they brought to was the humanity and the characters. Having that comic relief of the badinage between Sir Wilfred and the nurse, Miss Plimsoll, and having a little bit of a relationship built up with Vohl and his wife, and just the little bits as well where Vohl, they have flashbacks to Vohl with Miss French, the character he ultimately is accused of killing, which do kind of take us out of that just courtroom and legal chambers kind of thing, and widens out the world of the movie a lot, which really does work really well on, and we get to understand the characters a lot better. And that's one of the virtues that Wilder brings to this. In an Agatha Christie story, the person who's murdered doesn't really matter. They're just a chess piece there to hang the rest of the plot off, which is a very bad mixed analogy. But in this one, Miss French is a person in the film. She has a background. She has a little bit of character. There's a whole bunch of stuff there which is added and does kind of give us a sense that her death matters, which is one of the great things lacking from those Agatha Christie type stories. The fact that a human being's life has been cut off is of less importance than how it was done. And Wilder brings a strength to that weakness in the kind of Agatha Christie type of story. One of the nice things too is Marlene Dietrich at the time was something like 56 years old, and she looks fantastic in this film. This is before there was much in the way of plastic surgery, though she may have had a bit of work done. But she just looks terrific for somebody that age in this film. She's the sexiest looking grandmother you're going to see in a 1950s movie. And she brings she somehow portrays a vulnerability to Christine ultimately that really is a revelation, and it's a really touching piece when somebody is such an iconic figure in cinema the way that Dietrich was. There can be a tendency to kind of rest on that laurel and to just kind of cash the checks based on that iconography. But in this movie, she doesn't. Yes, she does play to it a little bit in the scene in the bombed out nightclub in Berlin, but it's just more of a nod than an essential thing to it. The Christine character is one of the great female roles in crime drama cinema. She's complicated, she's intelligent, she's resourceful. She outthinks the best barrister in England. And that really is lovely to see. Both of these films, in a sense, have strong female roles in it, which is something I'm increasingly drawn to with classic cinema. The idea that there are movies, and I talked about this when I talked about The African Queen on the radio, how strong a character Rose is in African Queen, played by Katharine Hepburn. Really kind of, you know, forthright, and she's the sister of a missionary in the jungles of Africa who only went along because she was a spinster and didn't have any other opportunities, but in the right circumstance becomes a force of nature almost, and ends up sinking a German gunboat. So, but that's digressing a little bit, but those kind of female roles are really not as common as we'd like them to be in classic cinema, but of course they're much more common now, and they've become kind of the default setting in a certain type of modern film. But it's only because of strong female characters in earlier films, people like Katharine Hepburn and Ida Lupino and Marlene Dietrich and Betty Davis and a bunch of other people, Virginia McKenna in Carve Her Name with Pride, things like that, that kind of strength of character really does work well in a courtroom drama, because actors love courtroom dramas, of course, because it gets you a chance to make speeches, you're talking about ideas. The drama is implicit in the setting. That life and death kind of thing is all part of a courtroom drama. But this is, in a sense, after a while, after you've seen this film, it's not about the courtroom machinations as much as it is what goes on outside the courtroom, which is really kind of interesting. The things done outside the courtroom, some of them involving Marlene Dietrich and Charles Laughton, some of them involving Tyrone Power and the actress playing Miss French, and I've totally gone blank on her name. But anyway, that envelope around the courtroom drama really does make it a much more complicated and interesting thing. There was a big fuss at the time the film came out because they didn't want people to do spoilers on the ending, and there were the trailers for the film really emphasise that, and there is a bit of voiceover at the end of the credits of the film telling people not to tell other people the give away the spoilers essentially of the film. And I'm not going to do it either. I think you should see the film and go for the ride of it. It really is a lot of fun. As I said, it is in black and white, but it's really well shot. The set design is extraordinarily good. The cinematography by Russell Harlan is excellent. Billy Wilder's direction, and there's not a dull character in the film. It really is a wealth of riches. You can sit back on a Sunday afternoon, and if the weather's anything like it is here at the moment, you're going to want to, and just kind of go along for the ride. If you haven't seen it, enjoy it. If you have seen it before and haven't seen it for a few years, which is how I came to it for this podcast, there really is stuff to rediscover there where you go, oh, that is so cool, or ah, you know, those kind of moments. There are a number of them in this film, and just that pleasure of watching Charles Laughton and Elsa Lanchester play off each other is another one of the great joys of Witness for the Prosecution, that I really think that people should grab a hold of it. It's a lot of fun. It's an entertainment essentially, but it's incredibly well crafted and incredibly smart entertainment as well. So I'm going to take another break now. There's not too much feedback, but I'm going to see what I can pop up with, and we'll wrap up this puppy. It's not going to be a particularly long podcast, and I do apologize for that.
It seems to me that I've tried long enough to prove to you my love is strong enough.
Just how upset can you get?
How hard to get can you get?
I'd love to get a sailboat to China all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in arms evermore. Leave all your lovers on a faraway shore. Out on the briny to the moon big and shining, melting your heart of stone. I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone.
On a slow
not on
boat
a fast or slow boat. You're not gonna take my heart. You're not gonna break my heart.
Alone, I'm gonna make you mine.
You'll have to stand in line.
Get you and I'll keep you in my arms.
Now there's
evermore.
No
leave all your lovers on the shore.
For me, they'd swim to China and
tell them
back
to bring me an anvil.
Out
on the briny with a moon
not even
big and shiny.
It's
melting your heart.
Or maybe we'll stay at home.
Stone, or is it made of steel?
You'll find it's very real.
Seems we're not going on a slow boat to China. Well, let's just say that we won't be there this June. Cause who ever heard of a Chinese honeymoon?
Okay, I'm back, and it's just occurred to me, and this is totally silly, that this podcast represents the fifth anniversary of Paleo Cinema. 5 years ago in 2007, I started this out. I was in a different job. I was actually living in the same house, which is a continuity thing, but I was in a different job. I was really in a different headspace than I am now, and doing Paleo Cinema really has kind of enriched my life in a lot of ways. The feedback from the listeners, the fact that it's spun on to the job doing the ABC local radio and Darwin gig, the spin-off of the Martian Drive-In podcast going to my other love, science fiction and genre cinema. It's been a really nice 5 years of my life learning how to communicate with people with my voice. I did learn at a very early age at some rudimentary level I could communicate, but communicating complex ideas and painting pictures about a visual medium with my voice is something that I've learned to do, and I've got slightly better at over that half a decade since I first did Paleo Cinema. And I really want to thank people for listening. I want to thank the other podcasters out there who really do form a community, and we human beings really do form communities. That's the essence of humanity, is to create communities, and we do that with podcasting as well. People like Zom and Sammy and Big William and the Bryn over at Hammockus and Vince, Mary and Nick and Juan and all those guys over at the B Movie Cast. And in Australia, people like Mondi and Mitch and Dave and the feminist cabal over at Galactic Suburbia and Kirsten McDermott and all these other people. We're just woven together, even if there is kind of a 6 degrees of separation between some of those people, that richness of the democratization of media. This kind of stuff that I'm doing now, it goes all across the planet. And I'm not kidding when I say that. It goes everywhere from the coast of China all the way across to the west coast of the US, the long way around. It goes from Tasmania all the way up into Scandinavia. It really does get around the world. And that's scary to me at times, but it's also incredibly gratifying for me to have that opportunity, which before the last 8 years wasn't really available to us. That democratization of media, I have a wider reach than most media outlets in traditional media before the internet came along. And that's an astonishing thing. I've lived most of my life without the internet. Remember, I'm 55 now. I've lived most of my life before the internet. I hope to live more of my life with it than I do without it. But at this stage, I still have that sense of wonder about the technological changes that let me do what I like to do and that let me talk to people across the planet, and Skyping with Dr. Zom or Brian over at Hammockus, or even just people in my own town that for some reason I can't get to talk to. I really treasure that use of technology and that kind of grassroots use of technology that enables this stuff and enables us all to do this stuff and enables me to be talking in your ear, whichever part of the planet you're on, where the seasons may be different than mine and the weather's different and the view outside the window is undoubtedly different. I really treasure that, and I'm going to continue to do it. There's no way I'm not going to do it unless I get a total brain fart or I drop off the twig, which I'm not intending to do for at least another 45 to 50 years if I can possibly avoid it. But I'm going to keep doing this stuff because it enriches me. I believe that from the feedback I'm getting that people enjoy it, and I think that contributing to the group mind of the planet that the internet is going to one day become is a very cool and groovy thing. So having said that, I'm going to end this one. Didn't get particularly any usable feedback, but I do have one thing to tell you. If you go to paleocinema.com, there's a little microphone widget on the right-hand side of the screen. If you have a microphone at all, and even just the one on your laptop, I don't give a fuck about the sound quality. You can send a voice message through that, and I will get it, and I will play it on the podcast, and I'll feedback on it too. I've also got that on the Martian Drive-In one. Lovely little widget that Vince Rotolo grokked for me. And I don't know whether you want to do that or not, or whether you just want to put things on the Facebook page, Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. Whatever it is, I really like a bit more feedback than I'm getting at the moment on this one. And I really want to be able to contribute by getting that feedback. That feedback's important for me to know that I'm going to keep doing the stuff that people enjoy listening to. Martian Driving Podcast, maybe because of the novelty, is getting a little more at the moment, but maybe that's the nature of doing it monthly, alternating the two every 2 weeks. I don't know. It's the first time I've tried this thing. But thank you very much for listening, and I really do treasure every person who downloads the podcast. It's a really life-affirming thing for me to have that, and it's even better if you listen to it too. But anyway, that's about it for this time around. In 2 weeks' time, I'll be chatting with Narelle Harris, vampire author and very, very nice person, about a couple of vampire films for the Martian Drive-In podcast. Remember, I said I was going to do horror as well as science fiction, and remember now that the Martian Drive-In podcast has its own RSS feed. And you can go to either of the websites to pick up on that and listen to it separately. I wanted to give it its own identity, and by splitting up the RSS feeds, I've managed to do that. But Sal says hi, everybody. She's not coming on this podcast like I said that she would on Facebook. She's got a couple of other things on at the moment, but she's still here, and she's very important support for me. She gives me the space to be able to do this without hassle. And when things get busy and real life interferes with things, that's something really to be treasured. The fact that she gives me that space and that support and lets me piss away our money on microphones in bad acoustic rooms. She's been essential to what I do here. And her contribution, even though it's not always on the podcast itself is of inestimable value to me. But anyway, enjoy your movie watching. I'll be back in 2 weeks with a Martian Drive-In podcast, and in 4 weeks with another Paleo Cinema, and I may get a guest that time around. But take care of yourselves, and I'll be back very soon. Bye.